Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with John Manley, who's a Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Stanford University. He wrote an article some weeks ago that was published in the Los Angeles Times titled, Take Time to Question Rush to War. The U.S. Drew the Wrong Lessons from September 11th Terror Attacks. So we'll be talking about the idea that that the war on Iraq is the worst possible response to the war on terror, and that the United States is actually being goaded into war by hopeless fanatics, to quote Professor Manley. We'll also speak with Michael Lind, who has written a new book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And we'll be talking to him about what George Bush represents in terms of a kind of buccaneer capitalism from Texas. He describes him as a complete disaster as a president. And he's formerly worked with William F. Buckley and has made something of a migration from the right to the left. So we'll be talking to Michael Lind, and then we'll talk with Josh Marshall, who wrote a piece in the current issue of the Washington Monthly profiling Dick Cheney. And the conventional wisdom is that Dick Cheney provides adult supervision and experience for George W. Bush, but Josh Marshall's article takes quite a different take. It's titled Vice Grip, Dick Cheney is a Man of Principles, Disastrous Principles. And we'll talk to Josh Marshall about his tracking of Dick Cheney's activities in the White House, and suggesting that Dick Cheney is a total incompetent, which is certainly not a commonly expressed view in the mainstream press. I'm speaking with John Manley, who is a professor emeritus of political science at Stanford University. As I mentioned, you're the author of this piece in the Times recently. And I'm just quoting you by saying that we are being goaded into war by hopeless fanatics. And, I mean, give us a brief sketch of what the U.S. should have done and what a more mature foreign policy would represent.
Yeah, my concern and why I wrote the article is that it seemed to me that the question that was not being asked in the United States, and certainly not in Washington, was the question of, you know, why the United States was on the receiving end of such hatred and such violence. And the article basically makes the case for stepping back from, you know, just a knee-jerk reaction that the lesson we should draw from 9/11 is, let's go, you know, kill people, let's go get, you know, Al-Qaeda, let's go get Osama, and when they kind of fade out, let's go get Saddam Hussein, and now let's go get, you know, North Korea, although North Korea is apparently powerful enough that we're walking a little bit more gingerly in that area. And now you're beginning to hear talk about the axis of evil in Latin America, with, you know, several countries electing fairly left, liberal, or socialist presidents. Ecuador, Venezuela, Brazil, and of course, you know, our old friend Castro. So, for me, the lesson that should be drawn from 9/11 is not necessarily that the best thing to do in response is, you know, send battleships over with hundreds of thousands of troops and start invading countries, which it seems to me is only going to provoke more and more anti-American feeling, more and more hatred, and more vulnerability and likely casualties, not just on the battlefield, but at home, as we witnessed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the fields of Pennsylvania. I think the real lesson of 9/11 is that despite all our military hardware, and the same kind of argument goes for Israel, we're extremely vulnerable. And a very small handful of people can do enormous damage to innocents on the home front and not just abroad. So I think we ought to take into account the fact that our military superiority in mass a great deal of vulnerability if people are in fact willing to die for their causes and are animated by the kind of hatred that they obviously are. So, you know, why do they feel this way is the first question I think should be discussed. And secondly, once you examine that question, what can we do about it as opposed to just invading somebody?
Well, indeed, 9/11, for a while there, after 9/11, the United States was considered the victim, and there was a great deal of international sympathy. And I think that's the major indictment of President George W. Bush, is that he seems to have turned the world against America with what is perceived as a sort of belligerent and arrogant foreign policy and attitude, and it hardly is in the interest of the United States to have the world hate us. But let me just tell you, one of the things that's interesting is that there were vast demonstrations about San Francisco and
right.
and in Washington on the weekend, and
yeah, hundreds of thousands,
and all around the world too.
Yeah.
And much of the best analysis and reaction to George Bush's foreign policy, I've noticed, has come from Europe. There, in Wednesday's Times of London, there was an article by John le Carré, the novelist,
right, sure.
which was reprinted on the front page of Le Monde.
Uh-huh.
It's titled, "The United States of America Has Gone Mad."
Yeah.
Let me just read a little bit of it, and then
right.
and we can talk some more. This
sure.
is from le Carré. They mentioned in the LA Times today that this was reprinted on the front page of the Le Monde, but I wish it was reprinted over here. This is his article, John le Carré. The United States of America has gone mad. America has entered one of its periods of historical madness, but this is the worst I can remember, worse than McCarthyism, worse than the Bay of Pigs, and in the long run, potentially more disastrous than the Vietnam War. The reaction to 9/11 is beyond anything Osama bin Laden could have hoped for in his nastiest dreams. As in McCarthy's times, the freedoms that have made America the envy of the world are being systematically eroded. The combination of compliant U.S. media and vested corporate interests is once more ensuring that a debate that should be ringing out in every town square is confined to the loftier columns of the East Coast press. The imminent war was planned years before bin Laden struck, but it was he who made it possible. Without bin Laden, the Bush junta would still be trying to explain such tricky matters as how it came to be elected in the first place, Enron, its shameless favoring of the already too rich, its reckless disregard for the world's poor, the ecology, and a raft of unilaterally abrogated international treaties. They might also have to be telling us why they support Israel in its continuing disregard for UN resolutions. But bin Laden conveniently swept that all under the carpet. The Bushies are riding high now, with 88% of America wanting war, we are told. The U.S. defense budget has been raised by another $60 billion to around $360 billion. A splendid new generation of nuclear weapons is in the pipeline, so we can all breathe easy. Quite what 88% of the Americans think they are supporting is a lot less clear. A war for how long, please? And at what cost to American lives? And at what cost to the American taxpayer's pocket? And at what cost, because most of these 88% are thoroughly decent human beings, in Iraqi lives? How Bush and his junta succeeded in deflecting America's anger from bin Laden to Saddam Hussein is one of the great public relations conjuring tricks in history. But they swung it. A recent poll tells us that one in two Americans now believe Saddam was responsible for the attack on the World Trade Center. But the American public is not merely being misled. It is being browbeaten and kept in a state of ignorance and fear. The carefully orchestrated neurosis should carry Bush and his fellow conspirators nicely into the next election. Those who are not with Mr. Bush are against him. Worse, they are with the enemy, which is odd because I'm dead against Bush, but I would love to see Saddam's downfall, not just on Bush's terms, and not by his methods, and not under the banner of such outrageous hypocrisy. And the article goes on as well.
Well, he, of course, puts it extraordinarily well. On one thing, I think he's not quite correct, and that is If you look at the polls, the American public is in fact much less hawkish than the White House and the advisors. Most of the American people, in fact, wanted to go much slower than Bush, and public opinion, in fact, supported the idea of working through the United Nations, which, of course, has caused Bush to back off from his immediate response and his immediate promise, which was, you know, let's go get him as soon as possible.
And apparently that's what he was saying in National Security Council meetings and to the Joint Chiefs, and continues to say, you know.
Oh, well, he's continuing to say it to the American public, but the public hasn't bought into it, you know, quite as, you know, nicely as the White House would like. And, of course, world opinion, working in part through the United Nations, has been, you know, dragging and stopping the hand of the administration, you know, bit by bit, I think, much to the consternation of Bush and the people like Wolfowitz and Rummy and others,
who think
the answer is go to war.
Which perhaps explains the recent petulism that George W. Bush indicated in the...
Yeah, well, you know, time is up, time's running out, you know, we're not going to wait, you know, much longer for these inspectors to go around, the evidence is already in. I mean, he's doing everything he can possibly do from the bully pulpit of the White House to fan the winds of war. He's in a position to do that. But world opinion and a significant number of Americans and American opinion aren't at all persuaded by this. And I think the demonstrations over the weekend testify to that. You know, even in little towns like I live now, Westport, Connecticut, we had a demonstration, you know, very soon after the announced policy of, you know, now that we take care of Afghanistan, let's go take care of Saddam. And, you know, there were thousands of people who came out to listen to anti-war messages from people like Joanne Woodward. And New York City had a big demonstration last fall. And it's clear that with the demonstrations over the weekend, even with a cold wave in Washington, D.C., people are willing to hit the pavement on behalf of peace.
Well, I think, though, obviously one would hopes that you can persuade people who support Bush. I mean, that's the idea of politics, is to, and that's where the left in this country fails, to come up with a better argument than Rush Limbaugh, even though clearly the media is rigged in favor of the right. Isn't it clear, though, that the argument you could make to supporters of Bush is that this man has been a disaster for American security? He has divided and alienated our allies and turned the world against us, and he has emboldened and dignified our enemies and united them.
Well, not only that, I think the argument that I tried to make in the L.A. Times op-ed piece goes a little bit farther. It says, you know, stop and think about opening up this country to the kind of vulnerability and the kind of warfare that 9/11 represents. And if you project 9/11 into the future, into an almost endless future, you can begin thinking about levels of carnage of innocent Americans on our own soil. That ought to give, the strongest supporter of George Bush pause. The problem is, I think, with the war fever that is afflicting many people in the country, though by no means all, and afflicting a large number of Republicans and conservative supporters of Bush, it's very hard to penetrate with a rational, reasoned argument that this policy is both self-defeating and questionable on, you know, many other grounds as well, ethical considerations being not the least of those.
Well, already the American abroad, whether it's a tourist, a missionary, or a businessman, is the new target in asymmetrical warfare.
Oh, yeah.
And as you say, that as the Bush military machine blunders around the world, alienating people, the war will come home. But
it already has.
But tell me, though, give us an alternative.
An alternative is peace. It seems to me that the United States has not always been perceived in the Middle East as the great Satan. We've not always been the, you know, prime public enemy number one. We have in the past attempted to work out a peaceful solution to the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, for example. Now it seems to me we're siding very much with the hardest of the hardliners in Israel. We're being perceived as supporting them. We're continuing to arm Israel to the teeth, though not particularly adding to their security, since they are increasingly vulnerable, as we are, to, suicide bombers and the like. Our $3 billion a year that we give Israel is going to prop up a regime that is acting against, I think, the interests of Israel, the interests of those in Israel who, in fact, want to live in peace with the Palestinians. It's beginning in Israel, of course, to provoke some resistance as well. There's a,
secular party.
Labor Party leader that's challenging Sharon and that has some chance, it seems now, of gaining some power. There is, and this is important, there are the people in the Israeli military, the Courage to Refuse group. It's about 500 now, according to Robert J. Lifton. And they are refusing to enforce the military suppression and the kinds of atrocities that are being meted out by Israel in response to the kinds of atrocities that Israel's policies, now supported, I think, unduly by the United States, are inflicting on Israel and on the Palestinians in a kind of mutual destruction pact.
Well, you could make the point that Israel, as a nuclear power and as a mini military superpower, cannot use military force to break the will of the Palestinians. I mean, clearly.
Well, the irony of that, of course, is that weaponry doesn't buy you security. What it seems to me will buy you security, both in the United States and in the Middle East and in Israel in particular, is a policy that drives toward peace and that drives toward pacification and that renews a peace process which has now been, for going on 2 years, suspended.
Well, John Manley, do you think that, I take great heart from the demonstrations that took place yesterday, both in San Francisco and Indianapolis and many cities around the world, in Washington, D.C., where people are holding up signs like no war for SUVs.
Right.
and it wasn't a group of people that can be easily dismissed as the usual suspects in demonstrations. There
are
lots of middle-class people. And World War II veterans, too, are apparently a new and growing and vocal bloc, albeit a generation in its 70s and 80s, that are very much opposed to this.
Well, a lot of people are, the opposition is clearly building, and it's building not just to the war, but to the kinds of things that this planned war and this exaggerated response to 9/11 is creating at home. Things like the Patriot Act, for example. The American Civil Liberties Union and a lot of other people who are concerned about, the domestic consequences on our rights and liberties here, not alone, not to mention our right to live and our physical security, are very much motivated to oppose this administration and these policies. And so you're getting a kind of multifaceted coalition created by this policy that I think will in time, and already has, reinforced feelings around the United Nations and throughout the world that this policy, as Le Carré put it so well, is in fact mad. and self-destructive, not just for us, but for, you know, people in Israel and people throughout the Middle East and other parts of the world too. The United States, you know, which is now the world's dominant superpower, the great hegemon, under the preemptive war strategy of Wolfowitz and Condi Rice and the Bush administration, you know, seems hell-bent on stomping all over the world and using military power to enforce our will, you know, wherever we damn well please. That's a recipe, it seems to me, for the destruction of American power in the world, and for the destruction of what, you know, better things the United States is, you know, at least on paper, is supposed to stand for.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with John Manley, who's a professor emeritus of political science at Stanford University. I'm now speaking with Michael Lind, the author of Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. And Michael Lind is a Whitehead Fellow at the New American Foundation. And Michael Lind, we spoke a number of years back when you wrote an article suggesting that the Republican Party getting into bed with the Christian Coalition was a fatal mistake, and that I think you even used the analogy of people, you know, the German establishment thinking Hitler was maybe it's a little odd, but he was at least bringing the votes in. If you go to South Carolina, the experience of what rescued George Bush's political career in terms of the presidency, he was on the ropes after New Hampshire, and it turned around in South Carolina, and apparently he pulled out all the stops, at least Karl Rove did, and they employed the Christian Coalition, and afterwards you recall that his opponent, John McCain, had kind of a meltdown and accused Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson of being agents of the devil. So do you think that a deal was struck there and that has had an effect? I know we're going to talk about the Southern strategy and the Southern politics, but just in the context of who rescued this guy's attempt to become presidency and what the deal was. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, I think it's a mistake to try to interpret George W. Bush's relations with the religious right as arm's length negotiation with an interest group that he's not identified with. That was certainly the case with his father, the first President Bush, who had very strained relations with the religious right and the Southern right in general, since he was a New England patrician by origin. In the case of George W. Bush, as I argue in my book, Made in Texas, he's a genuine cultural Texan and cultural Southerner, even though he was born in Connecticut to Northeastern parents. It's evident from his entire record and his own statements that he's a fairly run-of-the-mill Southern Protestant conservative himself, and of course he was born again, he claims. He was brought from his kind of mild mainline Protestantism to a very fundamentalist type of evangelical Protestantism at the age of 39 by none other than the Reverend Billy Graham, according to George W. Bush himself, an account of his midlife crisis and conversion. So I don't think it's the case that he's essentially a country club Republican who's playing footsie with the religious right. I think he is a member of the religious right. I've seen no evidence that his statements about the importance of this kind of Christianity in his personal and daily life, as well as his policy, are affectations. I think he's quite sincere.
Well, indeed, you could make the argument that prior to him being born again, he had apparently a problem with alcohol. His businesses failed. He was using his father's contacts to get into business and failing, and then using them to clean up the mess, and then sort of going nowhere and hanging out at the White House, and then suddenly he is born again, and lo and behold, he becomes President of the United States. So nobody's going to tell George W. Bush that Jesus Christ entering his life wasn't a good thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of electoral calculation. It's hard for people outside of the South to understand. You know, the usual image is that fundamentalist Protestants tend to be ignorant rednecks who live in trailer parks. That may be the case in the West Coast or the Northeast. It's not the case in the South, where you can be a governor or a bank vice president or a CEO of a corporation and believe in a very literal form of biblical fundamentalism. You know, for example, Bush has said repeatedly that there's evidence that Darwin was wrong about evolution. You know, well, anyone outside of the South would be laughed at, you know, in a position of public responsibility saying this. Even the Vatican, you know, has conceded that Darwin's account of evolution is correct. But in the South, such is the power of fundamentalist churches, particularly the Southern Baptist Church, which some people have called the established church of the South, that far from you know, marginalizing you, this indicates that you're part of the mainstream at the elite level, and not just some sort of rural parochial subculture. In my book, Made in Texas, I quote George W. Bush's description about the only trip he ever made to the Middle East, which was paid for by a very well-funded pro-Israel lobby. The rather frightening thing about his account of his brief tour of Israel is that not only are there no Arabs in this account, there are hardly any Jews. He treats the Holy Land, to use the term of the Protestant fundamentalists, as little more than the stage where Jesus, his personal Savior, walked. So he describes going to where the Sermon on the Mount was preached, you know, the Sea of Galilee, this and that. And, you know, if Jewish Americans as well as Arab Americans read this, you know, they must have some misgivings, because it's clear that he sees Israel and Palestine primarily through the prism of his own personal connection, as he believes it, to Jesus Christ.
But if you watch Christian, in quotes, television, it's all about the Book of Revelation and selling Armageddon to shake people down for money. And does he go that far? Because the irony of the compact between the right-wing Likud party in Israel and the Christian coalition in the United States is that the Christian right is simply using the Jews as a mean to provoke Armageddon so that there'll be the rapture and the righteous will rise and us poor sinners will be writhing in the pit of hell.
Well, I don't think, according to their so-called dispensationalist ideology, they can actually hasten Armageddon, but many American Southern Protestant fundamentalists and their allies, they have some allies in the rest of the United States and even in other parts of the English-speaking world like Australia, believe, according to the theory of John Nelson Darby, who was a 19th-century English theological eccentric, that all of the Jews in the world have to be gathered in the Holy Land, in the territories of ancient Israel, which includes, of course, the Palestinian territories and parts of Syria, in order for the Battle of Armageddon to take place and for the end of the world to come and for Jesus to descend as a literal physical dictator, literally ruling the world for 1,000 years from present-day Jerusalem. This is not mainstream Protestant theology. You know, most Protestants, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Methodists, Lutherans, reject this kind of millennial fantasy the same way that the Catholic and Orthodox churches do. But it has become the Orthodox doctrine of the Southern Baptists, of Pentecostalists, of many American Protestant fundamentalists, to the extent that many churches in Texas and other southern states are now raising millions of dollars as part of an adopt-a-settlement program, where in violation of U.S. law and of international law, they are sending money to help Jewish settlers on land that has been stolen from the Arab inhabitants who've been kicked out of their own homelands as the Israeli government, and it did this continuously under both Labor and Likud prime ministers, continues to expel Palestinians, bulldoze their homes and neighborhoods, and then ship in Jewish settlers from Israel and Jews from other parts of the world. They're now being subsidized by American Protestant fundamentalists.
But still, the motive is not that they give a damn about the Israelis or the Palestinians. They just
no, of course not, because according to this dispensationalist ideology of the Southern Protestant fundamentalists, the Jews have to be gathered in the Holy Land in order that they can all be killed.
well.
In order, basically, to gather them together for genocide. They don't use these terms.
Right.
But according to their interpretation of the Book of Revelation, all of the Jews will be killed in Israel, except, according to some variants, 144,000, which is a number that appears in the Book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And in some variants of this theory, 144,000 Jews will adopt Jesus mm-hmm. as their Savior. Of course, then they'll be killed too.
Well,
however, unlike the other heretical Jews, these last-minute Christian converts will be resurrected after the Battle of Armageddon and will live on the earth and be governed by Jesus during the next 5,000 years. So essentially, the Protestant fundamentalist theology holds that all of the Jews in the world must be gathered together in Israel so they can all be killed in the relatively near future as part of a great battle between God and Satan.
But if the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States, he may not share these beliefs in an identical way, but he certainly is a part of this religious group, the Christian right. This is a conflict of interest in terms of geopolitical leadership in a most fundamental way.
Well, maybe so, but you've got to remember most of this dispensationalist ideology about Israel and Christian Zionism came out of Britain.
Right, but you can't be running the world and want the world to blow up. I mean,
No, but if you go back to Gladstone, for example, you know, or Lloyd George or Asquith or some of these British prime ministers in the early 20th century,
mm-hmm.
they were very much like American conservative Republicans like Bush now. I mean, they were very devout Protestant Christians. Many of them were Christian Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I see this as part of the corruption of the American Republic by a British imperial tradition, because it's the British Empire that, guided by devout Protestant evangelicals who were Christian Zionists that established the State of Israel in the first place, we have now succeeded the British Empire as the imperial protector of Israel in the Middle East. And the Americans who support this neo-British role for the Americans in the Middle East tend to be the Americans who inherit this British ideology of Darbyism from mid-19th century in England. So I think it's a departure from the American mainstream tradition in foreign policy, but there are, you know, precedents for it in the history of the British mm-hmm. Empire.
But Michael Lind, the current Anglican Church, the Episcopalian Church...
Oh, sure, this is all dead in Britain itself. This has been dead for 60, 70, 80
right.
years.
In fact, if anything, they're quite the opposite. And in fact, the head of the Episcopalian Church in the United States has come out against George W. Bush and his plans for a war in Iraq in a most vehement way. Let me remind the audience, if I can, that I'm speaking with Michael Lind, the author of a new book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Just to return to that, to the Southern Takeover of American Politics, when LBJ signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, he said apparently to those gathered around him that this will be the end of the Democratic Party in the South. And you know, I've interviewed Kevin Phillips before, who was associated with the Southern strategy that Nixon employed. And clearly, the Republican Party, if you look at all of the mandarins in government at the moment, George W. Bush, the army who just left,
Bill Frist,
and his successor before him, Lott from Mississippi. A lot of them were actually what used to be Democrats too. So it's a fact. Now, is this when people say in the current context of President Bush's University of Michigan speech about affirmative action, they say that, well, he really wants to bring the blacks and Latinos into the Republican Party, but he's getting pressure from his right wing who he has to placate because of their obsession with quotas or their belief that affirmative action equals quotas. Is it the real George Bush? Is he the one that wants to, that speaks Spanish and wants to bring minorities into the party, or is he the one who is placating the former Dixiecrats who are now the core of the Republican Party?
Well, look, I'm one of the harshest critics of George W. Bush, but I happen to agree with him about this system. You know, Kennedy and Johnson and Humphrey and the civil rights liberals of the 1960s, including Martin Luther King was sort of ambiguous right before he died, but Bayard Rustin, who organized the March on Washington, they were unambiguously opposed to numerical racial quotas. And racial quotas were introduced in the United States not by liberals, but by the Nixon administration, which introduced the so-called Philadelphia Plan to have racial quotas in American labor unions. And after Haldeman died in his, this is Nixon's aide, John Haldeman, and his diary was published, it turned out this was a scheme by Nixon in order to pit blacks against white workers. And these and racial preferences have been incredibly divisive for 30 years, and they've basically benefited the right and hurt the left by driving away much of the white working class into the Republican. Of course, the Republicans have exploited this.
The Reagan Democrats, you mean?
Yeah, the Reagan Democrats, you know, but in a way the Democrats, you know, shot themselves in the foot by identifying themselves with, you know, these very crude racial quotas instead of other means. For example, you know, help to disadvantage people of all races, including poor whites. You know, the Democrats really lost the argument when Latinos replaced black Americans as the largest minority in states like Texas and California, which not coincidentally is where all of these, you know, popular initiatives and lawsuits are coming from. Because even if you could make a case to most white Americans that there should be some sort of racial preferences for black Americans because of segregation and slavery, it's just impossible to make a case of why you should discriminate against white students in applying to university on behalf of someone who came himself or whose family immigrated to the United States from Mexico or Argentina or Uruguay, you know, after the 60s, you know, and whose family never suffered any discrimination in the United States, you know.
But isn't there an element of hypocrisy here? I mean, you could make the argument that George W. Bush is an example of affirmative action for white people. I mean, he got into Yale not on his talent, but on his legacy.
This is true, but, you know, if the only argument that liberals make, as many liberals are making, is, well, we have these unfair legacy quotas for, you know, the mediocre children of Yale and Harvard alumni, therefore, I mean, that's not a defense of racial quotas. I argued in my book, The Next American Nation, back in 1995, that racial quotas should be outlawed and so should legacy preferences in favor of other methods, you know, that help out the disadvantaged. So, you know, the logical response to that is to be against both. Somehow this corrupt system of legacy preferences, from which George W. Bush benefited because he followed in his father's footsteps, thanks to legacy preferences to Andover, you know, and then to Yale. I just think it's an argument that liberals are going to lose. And I also think that it's a mistake to attribute Bush's intervention in this controversy to his southern right base as distinct from swing voters. Now, remember, he's got two challenges as a politician. He has to energize his base, which is mostly religious right, very conservative white southerners at this point. But he also has to win over the swing vote, which is largely white at this point in history. It's largely working-class whites in the Midwest and in the Northeast who have gone back and forth between the Democratic and the Republican parties. You know, so I think everyone interpreting this in terms of appealing to the neo-Confederates, I just don't think that's right. I mean, obviously, this, you know, they're against racial preferences in the same way they were against civil rights in the first place. But I think there are a lot of non-racist white working-class American swing voters around the country who are against segregation and were, but are also against racial preferences that this policy appeals to. So I think you have to distinguish Bush's intervention in the affirmative action controversy, which I believe is aimed towards swing voters, from things that are obviously directed at getting this old Southern segregationist Democrat vote, you know, like not criticizing the Confederate flag, like speaking at Bob Jones University, you know, which banned interracial dating, that sort of thing. I just, you know, he, like all politicians, he has both a base to worry about and swing voters to worry about.
Well, just in closing, then, Michael Lynn, what are the Democrats going to do since they have had a hard time holding the South, and the only Democratic presidents who have been elected in the modern era have either come from the South, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, or, in the case of Jack Kennedy, have taken on a vice president who was a southerner and a heavyweight, Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I think that...
I mean, who's, you know, Gore lost the South in the last election, and with the Democratic field, as large as it is, about eight of them are running now, it seems to me that they're balkanizing. You know, Lieberman's going to get the Jewish vote. Sharpton will get the African-American vote. You know, the Dean will get the gay and lesbian vote, you know, etc. I mean, where is the potential candidate that could carry the South?
Well, you've put your finger on two problems. The first is the balkanization. The Democrats really have not had a inclusive, uniting message since the 70s. They've been reorganized as a group of single-issue groups, you know, whether it's environmentalists, you know, the black civil rights establishment, Latinos, you know, gays and lesbians. And so it tends to be a bunch of single-issue groups who come together to nominate candidates and to vote, whereas the conservatives have crafted a very coherent ideology on everything from taxes, you know, to social issues, which appeals mostly to southern white voters, but it also appeals to people around the country, including a number of Latinos, very, very few African-Americans. So I think that's one question. You know, do they have a story to tell the country instead of saying, I'm going to give this group that and this interest group that, but, you know, just addressing people as Americans and nothing more. The second point is the regional electoral map. I think it was the case that up until Clinton, a Democratic president had to divide the South, at least peel off some southern states the way that Carter and Clinton did in order to get elected. I think the demography, though, is shifting in a different direction. The major growth in the Southwest and the Sun Belt comes from Latino immigrants who are still overwhelmingly Democratic. Even Bush bragged about he could get 40% of their vote, but that's a minority of the vote. The other mistake I think that electoral analysts, you know, who exaggerate the importance of the South for Democratic presidential candidates make is to neglect the critical role of the plain states, the upper prairie states and the Rocky Mountain states. Now, historically, these were part of the Franklin Roosevelt, you know, Kennedy Johnson Democratic coalition. They've essentially drifted into the Republican camp in the past 30 years as the Democratic Party has become more identified with urban issues on the East and the West Coast. But I think it's much easier to get these people from the Dakotas and Nebraska and Kansas back into the Republic, into the Democratic camp, than it is to try to win back most white Southerners. There is a substantial minority of white Southerners who are liberal and sometimes even radical. Clinton got 30% of the Southern white vote in both 92 and 96, but they're a minority, and the South, as long as it's got a white majority, is probably going to tilt Republican.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate your joining us, Michael Lind, and your book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics.
Thank you
for joining. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Michael Lind, who's the author of a new book, Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. I'm now speaking with Joshua Marshall, who is the author of an article in the current issue of the Washington Monthly, which is a profile on Dick Cheney, titled Vice Grip, Dick Cheney is a Man of Principles, Disastrous Principles. And Joshua, the current or the conventional wisdom has always been that Dick Cheney was brought on in vice president to provide adult supervision for an inexperienced younger president, George W. Bush, and that we should take comfort in this sober, steady figure. What you argue is that the man's a disaster.
I think it's the case, and I think now we have a two-year track record that's pretty hard to argue with. I mean, I think that very early on, when President Bush just, you know, I don't think anybody would disagree, just there were a whole lot of issues that he just didn't know a lot about. And obviously, Dick Cheney's been around government for a long time and knows this issue and that. But you look at instance after instance, and the issues, problems to manage that he's been put in charge of, he's just managed to screw up. And I don't mean that just from the standpoint of saying, you know, his positions are too conservative. Obviously, from my political vantage point, I'm going to disagree with a lot of the things he believes and does. But just on the level of competence, it's been a pretty, a pretty sorry tale. I mean, you go from the, you know, the Energy Task Force, the decision to shelve the Hart-Rudman recommendations about Homeland Security, and that's, this is, you know, 6-7 months before 9/11, the trip he made to the Middle East at the beginning of 2002, where he basically got, you know, went out there with a swagger, and he's going to get everybody in line behind our policy, and they just kind of handed him his head. And you know, the most, I think the most, well, on, you know, those are all...
Well, he also trashed the idea of Iraqi and UN inspectors in Iraq, and you say that Condoleezza Rice had to clean up that mess. You know, his energy policy is all drilling, nothing else. He resisted corporate reform, and they had to take the Senate bill because of their complete tin ear or deaf ear to what was happening on Wall Street. And then you also point out that he was the guy that his friend Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, he picked him in the first place, and then he had to fire him. And then his successor is also John Snow, is a friend of.
Right, and his successor, Secretary Designate Snow, is you know, there were three new members of the economic team that got appointed, must be 6 weeks ago now, and Snow was the one that everybody sort of got together and could agree was just a clunker of a nomination, and that was the one that Cheney was behind. So it's not just, I mean, there's a split in this administration. You can see it particularly in foreign policy between the more hawkish people around Cheney and the more sort of mainstream foreign policy types around Colin Powell. So there's that division. But just again, just on the level of being able to execute policies deftly or with any sort of, you know, semblance of competence at all, Cheney's been just a disaster. And I think that, again, there's this kind of continuing myth that Cheney is the sort of the wise operator behind the scenes, the one who makes the trains run on time and all those cliches. And ironically, it's one believed at least as much on the left as on the right. I mean, again, people left may disagree with his policies, but they think he's this sure hand. But we just have so many, you know, pretty much you can look at this administration, and if you see that Cheney's fingerprints are on a policy or on the execution of a policy, you can be pretty sure that it's going to end in, if not disaster, someone else having to kind of, you know,
clean up the mess.
Fix it up later.
Let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Joshua Marshall, who is the author of an article in the current issue of the Washington Monthly, a profile on Dick Cheney titled Vice Grip. Dick Cheney is a man of principles. Disastrous principles. And it's true that the liberals in this country from the very beginning of the George W. Bush presidency have had this comfortable delusion that the father phones in the agenda and that Dick Cheney is really in charge and that George W. Bush is a puppet. And of course the truth is that George W. Bush has always been in charge from day one, and he's aggressively in charge, and he almost has something to prove that he's not this boob. So he's a very activist president. So it leads me then to ask you, Josh Marshall, do you think that they're going to ditch Cheney for health reasons or whatever? They can have plenty. They've certainly got built-in excuses in for the 04 race.
I suspect they won't, and the main reason, I mean, there's two main reasons. One is that Cheney is sort of the head of the hard ideological conservatives in this administration. And the sort of the party's conservative base, I think, would look very negatively on his being removed, especially for the kind of people who might replace him. You know, one thinks of a Tom Ridge or someone like that, a kind of a more moderate, someone from a swing state, something like that. So I think politically, there'd be a lot of problems there. The second is that whoever was given the nod for 2004 as vice president would be the logical successor in 2008, in the sense that, you know, the vice president always is seen that way. And that would just make it such a hot political issue there would be so much controversy within the Republican Party about that, that I think it's just something they'd like to avoid. So I think absent some great deterioration in his health or him taking himself out of the running, I would be surprised if he's not the running mate in 2004.
And
all these disasters, notwithstanding.
Right. Well, in your article in the Washington Monthly, Joshua Marshall, you mention the fluff piece that Newsweek did on Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor. And I've actually heard this from a number of Washington insiders that she's the sort of the anchor there of sanity, if you will. Do you have any evidence that she's really has to clean up the messes that Cheney does? And
I think to the National Security Advisor, her role, that role is basically supposed to be a
invisible
coordinator.
Role, yeah, but they're not supposed to be up front, in particular.
Right, and so some of it. I mean, I really think, and this is. It's one of these things that's conventional wisdom, but I think also happens to be true, that the real anchor is Colin Powell on the foreign policy side. I think Condi Rice on the more managerial side of the question, in the particular case we're talking about here, this is, as you referenced before, Cheney went out and gave a speech that basically says inspectors would never work anyway, at the same time that the administration was trying to get back toward a more, at least somewhat more, UN-centered policy. And she had to go to Cheney and basically say, that's not where we're going, and get him to give a speech that basically walked that back. So on those kind of things, I think that she does play that role. But on a more substantive level, I think it's, in terms of the broad direction of the administration, it's Colin Powell, and that's because he's more senior, he has more political heft, and I think he has a more articulated vision of foreign policy in some ways than Rice does.
Well, he used to have a job. He was also the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I mean, there's just no question in the comparison of who's got the experience.
But, sure.
But still, what do you make of her coming out with a sort of limited defense of affirmative action after the president's speech?
I'm still trying to get a handle on what was going on there. The administration clearly, in sort of defense of its position on the Michigan case, tried to, kind of get the word out to reporters that she'd been in on this decision, had obviously supported this decision, et cetera. And then later she comes out with a statement saying that she does support a kind of affirmative action, possibly, but not this kind. So the whole message coming out of the White House was sort of one of equivocation. They didn't seem to really want to, bite the bullet on this case. And it's a little unclear to me whether her subsequent statement was part of that equivocation, part of a sort of a political strategy to kind of cover, cover all the bases, or whether this was her a little more on her own initiative, saying, I'll speak for myself on this. I, knowing what I do about this administration, it's a little hard for me to imagine it was the second, just because this president puts such a high premium on people not talking out of turn, on everybody being a team player. So I suspect this is part of a broader strategy, but honestly, I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, your article does prick this balloon that you've got Dick Cheney as a sort of sober anchor, the experienced guy, the old pro, the wise man, whatever. Where does that reputation come from? Because as far as I can tell, he's a man who literally went through the Washington revolving door from being Secretary of Defense into an oil services company, Halliburton, where he just made tons of money, and he got a $30 million payoff to come back when he retired. And when he was running Halliburton, his main contribution to the company was to buy Dresser Industries, which then meant that they inherited all these asbestos lawsuits. And indeed, here he's an example of all that's wrong with American capitalism that's been revealed in all these Wall Street scandals. He just got huge payouts for himself and left the company holding the bag. And indeed, left the people with pensions from Dresser in the lurch. Apparently, the pensions are worth half of what they were. So,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
This is just the worst example of slash and burn capitalism.
It's unquestionably true, and I think part of the answer to your question is just a mystery how his reputation has survived all these things. I think that the major part of the answer is that, you know, despite a relatively brief tour of duty at Halliburton, considering that, you know, the length of his career, you know, most of it has been spent in Washington. He was in the, you know, a functionary in the Nixon Ford era, then he was in the Congress, then he was the cabinet secretary. I think in some ways, he is the kind of he flatters Washingtonians' sense of their own importance.
Well,
how important it is.
$30 million indicates somebody values Washington.
Sure, and that's why Halliburton brought him in, because he knew the sort of he had contacts in Washington, right. And Halliburton's basically a government contractor, and what he brought to that company was not sort of business savvy, but connections. Because that's the way that company works. So
I'm afraid we've run out of time, Josh Marsh, but I thank you very much for joining us, and I recommend the Washington Monthly current issue, and of course at www.washingtonmonthly.com, for Josh's article, Vice Grip, Dick Cheney is a Man of Principles, Disastrous Principles. I thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and we'll have our website up very soon, so I'll let you know. Thanks, bye.